Hi, I'm Andy Malay. I've lived in the Hudson Valley most of my life, and here on the banks of the Hudson River in Kingston for over 20 years, I can tell you that this is no ordinary place. In the 19th century, Hudson River School painters such as Frederick Church brought the scenery of the Hudson Valley to millions of people, and writers like James Fenimore Cooper brought it to millions more. It's the birthplace of America's love affair with the environment and the birthplace of American environmental law. But in 1947, one of America's biggest corporations began dumping a chemical called PCB, polychlorinated biphenyl, into the river. By the time PCBs were banned in 1977, over 1 million pounds had entered the Hudson River ecosystem, most of which remains to this day. And what may prove to be a similar amount is trapped in the bedrock under the two factories that processed the PCBs, seeping into the Hudson even today, 20 years after production stopped. Health effects from exposure to PCBs fall in 3 general categories: cancer of several types, hormonal and reproductive disruption, and direct effects on the brain and nervous system. Scientists tell us that all human beings have PCBs in their bodies. That includes you and me. I had my blood tested. Here's what my PCB count looks like. Each bar indicates one type of PCB. Some are more dangerous, some less dangerous. This one, for instance, is called 245245, and it's the one I have the most of. It's consistent with the PCBs in the Hudson. PCBs enter the food chain from events like the General Electric spill, and they bioaccumulate. They build up as much as 1 million times so that animals and humans at the top of the food chain have the most concentrated levels of PCBs in their body fat. My PCB totals are 200 parts per billion. Many Americans have PCB levels in this range, and there are many sources. To determine if General Electric PCBs are responsible for Hudson Valley blood contamination, we need a full-scale sampling of levels in area residents. One thing, however, is certain. I never asked to have PCBs in my body. I don't want PCBs in my body, and I am deeply concerned about my family's health and future.
We have an Eat None health advisory for women and children for all species of Hudson River fish from all locations. Eating contaminated fish is considered one of the most potent routes of exposure to PCBs. And it's been well documented here on the Hudson River that despite our health advisories, people are fishing recreationally and eating their fish and passing their fish on to other people to eat, often their families or relatives.
What are the risks that we all face from exposure to PCBs? And what can we do to reduce or even eliminate these risks? This is what a PCB molecule looks like. The chlorine atoms attached to the outside of the 2 carbon rings are typical. And in this state, the PCBs are oily, heavier than water, and are often found attached to the small particles that make up river sediment. After the PCBs have been in the environment for a while, bacteria nibble away at the chlorine atoms like this. These PCBs are more water-soluble. They can lift off the sediment, dissolve in the river water, and even evaporate into the air we breathe. This is a machine used to sample PCBs in the air above river water and exposed tidal flats.
What we're doing here is we're measuring that PCBs that are being emitted from the sediments as the sediment dries. And what we have here is a fluorosil tube, which traps the PCBs on the fluorosil as they're drawn through. We have two, one which we'll have actually inside the sampler, which will draw the air over it, and then we'll have one which is kind of a control, which just draws the blank air from the outside.
It's 200 miles of polluted water, and a large amount of polluted sediment, which is exposed every 12 hours. And then when it floods, a whole lot more sediment comes out and is deposited on the bank. Now, it's obvious that that's going to evaporate into the air. Now, not being an atmospheric scientist, I don't know where it goes. But one of them told me that, in fact, it does go north, the whatever it is up there, the upper atmosphere. And, in fact, we have a very important problem around the Hudson's Bay with Inuit people that live there. Their breast milk is highly contaminated, partly because, well, mostly because they eat seals, and the seals eat the fish, and the fish are, in fact, getting contaminated by fallout from somewhere. And this is the most likely place.
Scientists are often alerted to the toxic effects of chemicals after they are observed in wildlife. Birds, fish, and other animals often play the role of indicator species, pointing the way to further study, which can lead to better understanding of potential human health problems.
The level of PCB contamination that we found in these birds, as measured by total tissue concentrations, as well as calculated dioxin equivalents, if these levels were found in more sensitive species of birds, like Caspian terns, Forster's terns, double-crested cormorants, they would be causing devastating population level effects. I think we need to think beyond the tree swallow and consider what PCBs in the Hudson River might be doing to other birds that are similarly exposed, shorebirds like the solitary sandpiper, birds a little bit further up the food chain like the greenback heron or the osprey, very importantly the bald eagle. A large number of them overwinter not far from here, and one or two pair are attempting to nest in the middle and upper sections of the Hudson River.
Well, I've seen outright death of wildlife from PCBs, from nothing more subtle than lethal levels of PCBs in the brain of a bird from their position in the food chain. We got a call a few years ago about a great horned owl that was acting weak along the Hudson River in Catskill, New York. So we went down and we got the owl. The owl came in, it was emaciated. It was showing tremors, and it died about an hour or two after we got it back in the lab. It didn't have any infectious or parasitic diseases when we examined it. Didn't have any physical injuries. It didn't have anything that we could see that could have caused that emaciation. It was an adult owl. It had a very small spleen, which made me suspicious that there might be something going on, like with PCBs, that might be suppressing the immune system. Anyway, when we looked at it, it had over 300 parts per million of PCBs in its brain.
I would allege to you that the ultimate pollution is pollution that affects the cognitive ability of the next generation.
A fast-growing body of current research indicates that PCBs have destructive effects on the human brain.
What I would like to present to you today is evidence that PCBs directly affect the brain, not mediated through anything else. And while I would acknowledge that our total body of evidence for that rather dramatic statement is perhaps not all in, but I would suggest that the book that can be written in a couple of years will focus on direct effects of PCBs on nervous tissue and the health hazard to humans that is posed from this. Parkinson's disease is a disease where you lack dopamine in the brain. Almost every drug that's used to treat mental illness is a drug that acts on dopamine receptors or dopamine content. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter which is intimately involved in mood, in behavior, in mental illness. And what we're demonstrating is that the PCBs that had been thought to be non-toxic are capable of reducing the amount of this transmitter, and Siegel and his colleagues have demonstrated that this is through an inhibition of the enzyme tyrosine hydroxylase, which is the rate-limiting enzyme for the synthesis of dopamine.
Another equally frightening way that PCBs can harm people is through some subtle and not-so-subtle impacts on the glands and chemical transmitters that control our ability to successfully develop, adapt, and reproduce.
What I'm referring to here are the natural chemical messages that come from our genes that become the instructions for that next generation: how to grow, how to develop, how to mature from a fetus to an adult. Those messages, after all, are life itself. Without them, there is no next generation, with no exception. And if those messages arrive distorted or disrupted or diminished or defiled in some way or another, altered by some unexpected interference, then the fetus that receives them grows up and becomes something different than it would have been. To begin with, everyone in this room is carrying several hundred synthetic chemicals that were not part of human chemistry just two generations ago. And some of these contamination levels are within striking distance of ranges known to cause reproducible effects in the lab. How widespread is widespread? As far as science can tell, there hasn't been a baby born on the planet for at least two decades without some degree of fetal exposure. Some more exposure, some less, but none. How widespread is widespread? These contaminants travel to the ends of the earth. One of the tragic stories that we tell in the book is about scientists working on the St. Lawrence River in Canada, studying the impact on native peoples, of eating at the top of a heavily contaminated food chain, one not unlike the one here in Poughkeepsie because of PCB contaminations in the Hudson. These scientists wanted to find a control group. They wanted to find a community of people who wasn't contaminated so that they could compare that group with the exposed group. So they went to the high Arctic, far northern Canada, far from civilization, far from what they thought were sources of contamination, and they selected as their control group a village of Inuit Eskimos, the native people of the Canadian Arctic. As they did their studies, they discovered that this community was even more contaminated than those living along the St. Lawrence because of the ways that these compounds are spread globally through atmospheric transport.
This book, co-authored by Dr. Myers, Dr. Theo Colborn, and Diane Dumanowski, chronicles the discovery of endocrine disruption. When Rachel Carson first raised the alarm about DDT and other chemicals like PCBs, we didn't have the technology to produce test results like this. Now that we can routinely identify toxics in parts per trillion, we can see how widespread this problem has really become.
First of all, the fetus is exquisitely sensitive. At extraordinarily low contamination levels, you can alter the path of development taken by a fetus. An important point here is that the science on which this is based does not rest on the classic toxicological experiment with cancer. It does not rest on extrapolating high-dose curves down to the low end of exposure. The lab work, in fact, that's been done on this issue has led to excellent understanding of the basic mechanisms that are involved. In fact, if you look carefully at some of this work, you realize that we know much more about the basic mechanisms of this issue than we do about many of the factors leading to the causation of cancer. The work over the first several decades on this issue focused largely on man-made chemicals that are capable of mimicking estrogen. But within the last 5 years, we've seen that expand, first to compounds that block estrogen, and now to things that interfere with testosterone, thyroid, and other parts of the endocrine system. Work with the best known of the endocrine disruptors, particularly diethylstilbestrol, or DES, has led to great scientific confidence about the predictive value of lab animal studies for anticipating human effects. The scientist and the father in me argues that we should take care of this problem now so that our kids can focus on all those other problems, all those other challenges they're facing as they grow up.
How did the PCBs get into the river in the first place? This is the Hudson Falls GE plant, a short distance from Glens Falls, New York. A mile south of here is GE's Fort Edward plant, where the PCBs were also used and dumped.
The Hudson Falls plant site was acquired by General Electric in the late 1940s, and had been a paper mill in the past. Production of capacitors was ongoing from the late 40s until probably the late 1980s when it was consolidated at the Fort Edward plant a little further downstream. PCB was used at the two plants probably until just before its ban. I think it was about 1975 when PCB use at Fort Edward and Hudson Falls was discontinued. After that, they went to some other substitute dielectric fluids that we also find underneath the plant site as well. PCB use at the plant site was brought in on rail cars from the producer. It was offloaded from the rail cars into the tank farm. It was refined and then placed into capacitors. As you can see behind me, the large red and white building is building one where most of the filling of the capacitors was done. It was taken from the tanks behind building one after it was refined and placed in the capacitors in the basement of building one. The capacitors were aluminum cans of various sizes that had the capacitor dielectric fluid was placed in it by flood filling, where the people who were working on the capacitors would place the capacitors in large vats of PCB, allow it to fill, then they were lifted up and the tops were soldered on them, and it was sent on, down the production line. The outfall, the 002 outfall that led into the river underneath the pump house, was fed by a collection sump that was underneath building one. The collection sump was fed by a series of drains beneath the floor that were carved into the bedrock beneath the building. The bedrock on the other side of the river is very close to the surface. It's only between 5 and 10 feet, 15 feet below the surface. So when the building was constructed, it was blasted into the rock. So the collection system that fed the outfall was directly exposed to the rock in many locations. So when the PCB oil would get into this collection system, not only would it go straight to the river, but it could also seep directly into the rock.
Now we know that the rock pit was fractured, and that enormous quantities of PCB gradually saturated the bedrock. So much PCB material, in fact, that it is being forced out of tiny fissures in the rock under the falls and into the river. 20 years after they were banned, General Electric's PCBs are still being discharged into the Hudson River.
So far, we've been able to identify a large area of PCB contamination in the rock, but as of this date, we have not determined the entire extent of contamination. What we do know is that there is an area probably about a third the size of the plant site, at least 100 feet deep, which is partially saturated with PCB oil. We know that when we removed the sediment from the tail race tunnel and from the Allen Mill, we removed over 50 tons of PCB material. What we've been able to identify both at this plant site and at the Fort Edward plant site downstream exceeds 300 tons that we've been able to identify already as out in the environment. At the Fort Edward plant site, the geology is a little different. It's significantly further down to rock. You have about 20 feet of sand, and then there's a relatively impermeable lake clay. In a closed depression in the lake clay underneath the Fort Edward plant site, we've identified one area where there's over 300 tons of PCB.
These men are some of GE's contractors. They walk out onto the exposed riverbed with protective clothing, turkey basters, and toxic waste containers to sop up the PCBs. Any large-scale cleanup downstream must wait until the bedrock, more than 200 feet below this plant, stops draining toxic chemicals into the river. What about a river cleanup? According to American law, the polluter, in this case General Electric, must pay to restore the environment to a reasonable facsimile of its former state. GE has been paying.
Generally what we ask for, they give us. They have their corporate finances in mind, but in general we've been in agreement as to what the steps are to take and what the path is we should go down to try to remediate these plant sites.
GE's willingness to clean up the two plant sites stands in sharp contrast to its 20-year fight to avoid dealing with the river itself. The most recent EPA data show that 70% of the PCBs going into the lower Hudson are coming from the sediment in one deeply contaminated area just south of the two GE plants.
We cannot do anything about this water until we get the sediment level lower. And we can only do that by removing the source sediment, which is causing it.
Dredging this hotspot would not remove all PCBs from the river, but would greatly hasten the day when 1 to 2,000 pounds of PCBs would no longer wash into the tidal Hudson every year. It would reduce the time needed for fish stocks to become safe to eat and reduce future human exposure to PCBs. How can we deal with 200 miles of river that have been poisoned? Will we ever be able to eat the fish again? A 200-mile shore-to-shore dredging operation is unthinkable. But what about dredging the hot spots where the highest levels of contamination exist? The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has been looking at this and other options since 1989.
EPA has been following dredging technologies, and we've selected dredging for remedial action at six other PCB contaminated sites. EPA does believe that dredging is possible and can be implemented, and that there are remedial technologies available at this time.
GE has been telling us for years that the river is cleaning itself, that PCBs will biodegrade to safe levels. But EPA scientists have shown that PCBs break down only partially, never completely. Once they break down, they become more mobile and may be more dangerous than ever.
Someone that lives down near the water is going to get about the equivalent of one very contaminated fish meal by living there all year. Now, that isn't very much. That's the good news. But the bad news is that often it's our poorer segments of society whose homes are down in the floodplain. These are the kids that already have the problems with the old leaded paint in the house that's going to reduce IQ. So while fish consumption appears to be the most significant source of exposure, we would not rule out a fact that breathing the air may be harmful as well.
More study is clearly needed, and we believe that the next critical step is to fund and conduct extensive blood sampling work among Hudson Valley residents. GE has also been telling us that dredging will create more problems than it solves. Showing us pictures of old clamshell dredges and slick publications like this, they claim the dredging will resuspend the PCBs and send them downriver. But dredging has come a long, long way in the last 20 years. Modern dredging technology is only half the answer, though. We need to find places to put the dredged material and communities willing to take it. The problem is, who can we ask to shoulder the PCB burden for the entire Hudson Valley? The answer is, of course, no one. But again, there are solutions that we need to be aware of. In 1994, Clearwater commissioned a report on treatment technologies for contaminated sediment. This report, along with other sources, demonstrates that there are lots of effective remedies available to reduce the PCB concentrations in Hudson River sediment to acceptable levels. With the sediment from the upper Hudson hotspot stripped of PCBs and other contaminants, such as dioxins and heavy metals, landfilled in a state-of-the-art containment system and immobilized, the long-term liability of the Hudson River PCB spill could finally be brought down to a tolerable level. We in the Hudson River Valley could already be experiencing subtle endocrine and neurotoxic effects from PCBs.
I have come to believe, on the basis of the work that undergirds our book, that some of the basic ground rules by which new chemicals and their derivative products are developed, tested, and brought to market, that some of those ground rules, all of them, need new examination. If we are really serious about creating a world in which babies can grow up toxic-free, in which babies can grow up in ways that allow them to explore their full potential. As laws and commerce work today, too much of the real testing of chemicals takes place in the real world. It takes place in our bodies, in our children's bodies, and in the global ecosystem.
It all comes down to human potential. As long as there are PCBs in the Hudson River, and as long as there are chemicals anywhere in the environment interfering with our hormones and our brains, we are the losers. We may never know what we might have been, what we might have become, what we might have accomplished, or how our children might have fulfilled their dreams had we lived in a world free of these chemicals.